From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. Let's talk about the gang MS-13, its gruesome violence, its origins in the streets of Los Angeles, its connections to the Civil War in El Salvador in the 1980s. Now the White House says MS-13 is a national security threat embedded in our immigration crisis. But people who study gangs say that's a misreading. This hour on Point, MS-13, what it is, what it isn't, and what it has to do with the border crisis. You can join us on air or online. What do you know about MS-13? Has President Trump convinced you that it's a threat? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, joining me first from New York is Hannah Dreyer. She covers immigration for ProPublica. She spent the last 12 months reporting on MS-13 in the greater New York area. You'll find a link to her most recent stories on our website, onpointradio.org. Hannah, thanks for joining me.
Good to be with you, John.
Hannah, let me just start with a question of origin. How did you get on the immigration beat, and how did you get on this story?
So I wanted to go somewhere where I could look at MS-13 on the ground, because President Donald Trump was talking so much about the gang and portraying it as this national, international threat, turning suburban towns into bloodstained killing fields. And so I wanted to go to one of those suburban towns and talk to the people who are affected by the gang and who are being recruited into the gang, who are policing the gang, to try to get a picture of what it really looked like.
Now, when you did the reporting, just there are some people who might wonder, and so I'll put the question to you, was that a dangerous assignment? Did you feel in jeopardy as you were reporting the story?
Well, that was one of the first eye-opening things for me. There was a lot of violence going on when I was starting to do this reporting on Long Island. Just before I started going out there, there was a quadruple homicide where four teenage boys were killed and their bodies were left in a park. And people were really scared. They were scared to talk to me. They were scared to open the door when I came knocking. But this violence is affecting just one specific community. It's really just immigrant kids, young people, or people who have friends in the gang or who might be targets for gang recruitment. And so I'm walking around out there and I feel sort of like an alien, like just invisible to the people who are perpetrating all of this really horrific violence. So it's spooky for me, but I don't think I'm really in danger.
Now, the particular immigrant kids who are in danger, are they from one particular country or is it Latino immigrants from multiple countries?
I'm seeing a lot of victims that came from El Salvador and Honduras, a lot of Central American victims. But there are also Ecuadorian victims, victims from Guatemala, victims from all over. The common denominator seems to be that these are Spanish-speaking kids. A lot of them are recent immigrants. And they're sort of in the mix at these high schools where the gang recruits people and preys upon people and commits a lot of violence in retaliation for things like trash talking in school hallways.
But violence only against members of the gang or potential members of the gang as opposed to others who might look askance at them?
Exactly. I think there's this feeling in the country right now that MS-13 might be coming for your children or might be, you know, hiding behind your house. And unless you're part of this group, it's so unlikely that you're going to come across this gang at all, which isn't to say that the gang isn't committing real atrocities. I mean, the violence that these kids commit really against each other is horrific and is wrecking lives and is terrorizing people, but not the community at large. And for me, that was really surprising to see.
It's interesting when you're describing how they are present, but in some ways, but not present in others, to people who are outsiders who may feel like aliens, as you mentioned. My daughters went to a high school, public high school in Montgomery County, Maryland, that was diverse ethnically, socioeconomically, and they told me from time to time that there were hints of MS-13 presence at the high school. They would see stuff in the bathrooms or something like that. But it never felt like a proximate threat to them. And so it was always hard for me to sort out what is the significance of this group, which sounds like it tracks your experience in New York.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's exactly where the gang is and has been, in the suburbs of New York, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in Texas, in California. And this has been something that's been going on for, 20 years at this point. And through that whole time, MS-13 has been in the United States, but I think it's been invisible to a lot of people. But, this gang hasn't grown in the last decade. There have been 10,000 members of MS-13 in this country going back, 15 years. And so they've been here. They're not new here. But it does seem like people, just because of this political moment, are starting to focus on them. But, this is a gang that was founded in the United States and then sent to Central America. It's a very American phenomenon.
The president talks from time to time, and he's talking specifically about Long Island, about having liberated towns from the scourge of this violent group. What is he talking about there? Is there anyone, perhaps the families of Latino kids, who in fact feel that they have been liberated or need to be liberated? Or how would you describe what you observed and felt in being in those communities?
Right. So since Trump came into office, he's tried to start deporting people who are suspected of MS-13 ties. So he's asked ICE to start doing these MS-13 raids. And then Sessions has also made this a national priority for the Department of Justice.
Were there not MS-13 raids when Obama or Bush were president?
There have been investigations into MS-13 for years and years. So Bush and Obama, I think together they arrested 8,000 MS-13 members over those two presidencies. And Trump is more or less tracking that. I think there have been maybe 700 or 800 MS-13 arrests since immigration arrests since Trump came into office. So it's not that this gang wasn't being policed, and now it is, but it's become more of a focus and more of a priority. And people on Long Island seem hopeful in some ways, and then also fearful, because a lot of people who are being rounded up in these ICE raids don't seem like MS-13 members. Some of them are high school kids who were drawing devil horns on their calculator or who were wearing the wrong color blue. And some of them have been rounded up by ICE but then let go after judges see the actual evidence against them.
Is it true that some communities themselves, not just a particular high school, but some communities feel some blanket of fear has been lifted from them because of this enhanced enforcement, or is that an invention of the president's?
I still feel a lot of fear when I go out to Long Island, because these gangs are still in the community. Yesterday, I was on Long Island talking to a group of teenage boys about the gang, and they didn't even want to say the gang's name out loud. They didn't want to say MS-13. And they said, "We're not snitches." They're scared to give any information that might make it look like they're trying to act disrespectfully toward this gang. But I do think that people are hopeful. I followed a mother whose son was killed by the gang in 2016 to a Trump rally last month. And she said that she didn't know quite what to make of what the president is saying, but she hopes that now that he's so fixated on this gang, he might make some positive changes. He might pressure police to solve her son's murder, which remains unsolved after 2 years.
So there are Latino families that are embracing, welcoming, thankful for what the president is doing?
I wouldn't go that far, but they're hoping that what the president is doing has some positive effect. This mother, when I was following her, was sort of pinging back and forth between a pro-Trump rally outside of this Trump event and the counter-protest, and she seemed sort of unsure where she wanted to settle down. Because so far, people are still afraid of this gang, and they're also afraid of ICE, and the victims of the gang feel like they haven't gotten justice. But it is it is possible, I think, in their mind, that Trump focusing on this gang, which is like this boutique gang that's been around all this time, it's not close to the biggest criminal organization in the U.S., I think they're hopeful that Trump focusing on that might end up helping them.
Now, one of the things the president has done is repeatedly offer lurid descriptions of horrific acts of violence. Are those accurate descriptions? And is there something different about the kind of violence that members of this gang perpetrate on themselves or people close to them?
Yeah, I mean, that's something everybody can agree on. This gang commits horrible, spectacular, really merciless acts of violence. I mean, every murder is brutal, but this is a gang that kills two-year-olds and, you know, slashes people's body parts off and then leaves them for their families to find. I don't think anybody is arguing that this is a bunch of nice kids who are being misconstrued as mean gang members. But I do think the violence is a lot less organized than people might think. People are maybe thinking of drug cartels or organized terrorist groups where the violence is committed towards some end. But with MS-13, it's really violence for violence's own sake.
Well, I want to talk to you when we come back about why that is, because that's interesting to me. But Hannah Dreyer, hold right there. We're talking about the criminal gang MS-13 and how it got embroiled in the immigration debate that's going on in our country right now. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking about the street gang MS-13. It's been responsible for gruesome murders in communities along the East Coast. Now the White House has brought the gang into the debate over its zero-tolerance policy on our southern border. You can join the conversation. What do you know about MS-13? Do you think they're coming across the border posing as parents to build up a criminal cartel here in the United States? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Hannah Dreyer, who spent the last year covering MS-13 in the U.S. for ProPublica. I'd like to bring in someone else who's an expert on MS-13, not just here, but in El Salvador as well. Jose Miguel Cruz is Director of Research at Florida International University's Latin American and Caribbean Center. He is himself Salvadoran. He joins us from Miami. Jose Miguel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
Before we start our conversation, I want to play one clip to set it up. This is from Bridget Nielsen, Kirstjen Nielsen, the president's Homeland Security Secretary. After President Trump described MS-13 gang members as animals last month, Nielsen went on Fox News to defend him and describe MS-13 crimes in grim detail.
We have everything from trafficked women whose head was bashed in 28 times to a gentleman who was stabbed 100 times, decapitated, and then his heart was taken out. So if anyone wants to quibble about whether we should call those people animals, perhaps the quibble should be whether we call them something worse.
Hannah, I just want to go back to the issue that we were talking about before the break, and that is, what explains this exceptional level of violence? Is it somehow a doctrinal thing within the gang? Does it have some sort of religious origin, ritualistic thing? Where does it come from?
This is a gang that was founded to give its members a sense of belonging. It was founded by Central American refugees in Los Angeles. And unlike other gangs that are out for money or status, these are people who, more than anything, are trying to belong to something. And that is really what the violence is about. So these are people who commit violence in large groups in the woods. Sometimes there'll be a dozen people all participating in a single murder. A homicide detective on Long Island told me he calls the group, the gang, Mighty Munchkins, because these are people who haven't yet finished growing, but they're all working together to commit these terrible acts of violence. And unlike other gangs where people are getting rich selling drugs, MS-13 members are working dishwashing jobs during the day because they don't really have businesses. They only have this violence.
Jose Miguel, give me your perspective on that question, because that I hear what Hannah's saying, but it still doesn't satisfy in terms of thinking about acts that we would consider inhuman. Like, what is the motivation for the intensity of that violence? What's your thought?
Well, there are two points on that. First, Hispanic gangs in general in the U.S. tend to be more expressive than any other type of gangs, right? So MS-13 is an Hispanic gang, was founded in L.A., and they basically took this way of being a gang member, meaning that they use the violence as an expression in expressive ways to show, you know, they control the barrio. That's one point. The second point is that the MS-13 that we have now, in some way, is the result of all these processes, social processes that went through Central America, right? MS-13 grew up, was founded in LA, but grew up and became the MS-13 that we know now in Central America, where violence is prevalent. Where the relationship between not only gangs but also governments and other criminal actors are basically defined by extreme levels of violence. And that way of behaving basically has been transmitted to the, in some way, as part of the DNA of the gang right now. So that they want to be notorious because of the level of violence they perform. But that's been basically shaped by the history of MS-13 in L.A. and then in Central America.
Can you explain the transaction? In other words, if the gang was founded in Los Angeles, how then did it get exported out of the United States and then take a different form and then return to the United States? If it was indigenous to the United States, why did that happen?
Well, fundamentally what happened was that during the 1990s, with the policies of deportation, a lot of people who grew up in the U.S., a lot of these refugees and sons and daughters of Salvadorian refugees who had grown up in L.A., basically all of a sudden were sent back to Central America, not even sent back, some of them. They went to Central America for the first time. They got there, and the only thing they knew about they belong about was to be part of a gang, right? What they did over there is they joined the existing gangs in Central America, and they transformed the gangs in Central America using these the fame of being or coming from LA, from the capital of gangs, right? And people over there adopted the culture, the norms, the way of being gang members from the United States. They adopted over there, and they started to transform over there. And that transformation was basically very much determined by the local conditions. And as I said before, the local conditions are very much shaped by the violence and crime that has been prevalent in Central America for all these years.
One quick terminological question. What does MS-13 stand for?
MS-13 stands for Mara Salvatrucha. Mara is a term to refer to a group in Central America, and Salvatrucha means a kind of a smart Salvadorian, something like that.
And what's the 13?
The 13, there are many versions about the origin of 13. Some of them say that is the position of the M in the alphabet. Some of them refer to other explanations, but actually there is no, I haven't been able to find a sort of consistent explanation about this, the meaning of 13.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. We've got Annie on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Annie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. I've been listening, and my family is from Nicaragua and other parts of Central America. And hearing this conversation is a bit frustrating for people that were born here and have family ties to that region and are in those communities where the people of that region congregate, because it is completely untrue that it has not infiltrated every part of our society, because it has. Knowing people very well that are involved in that and, you know, that perpetrate these kinds of things, like having, you know, connections is very common for somebody from there. Everybody knows somebody that's involved, unfortunately, in some way, your cousin's uncle's friend or your neighbor or something. And it is a community-wide problem. It is an everyone problem. It's not just a problem of Spanish people, and it's very white to sit there and think that is so absurd. And I can't stand our president, and I don't agree with him, but he's 100% correct about them. They are a huge problem. They shouldn't be here, and this shouldn't be going on, and they should be incarcerated or sent back. It's not okay, and it's more than just a Spanish problem, and it is a priority if it is a Spanish problem.
Annie, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate that perspective. And Hannah, what's your reaction to Annie's view?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. This is a group that is terrorizing a community, and I don't want to diminish that at all. And I've spent long nights talking to people who've lost loved ones at the hands of this gang, and they're still in pain, and that pain doesn't go away. When I say that it's not an issue affecting everyone, I mean it's not affecting everyone across the country. MS-13 is 10,000 members out of 1.5 million gang members in the country.
Do we know how many of those 10,000 are in California as opposed to the East Coast or elsewhere?
I think that the gang is still balanced more to the West Coast. I mean, even on places like Long Island, we're talking about maybe a couple hundred members at the outside. But, you know, a couple dozen gang members can do a lot of violence if they're just bent on committing as many murders as they can get away with. But when you talk about people outside of the Latino community and really the immigrant Latino community, I just don't think that this is an issue that most people in places like the middle of the country or other kinds of communities are seeing. I mean, we had that clip earlier where Trump was talking about calling MS-13 members animals. The White House put out a press release listing, I think, 7 murders that were animalistic. And of those, 6 of the victims were immigrants, and the 7th was a child of immigrants.
Let's go back to the phones. Leo is on the line from Baltimore, Maryland. Leo, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you. Appreciate you guys' focus on this matter. So I'm from El Salvador, and I have some friends that are either affiliated or know somebody who is affiliated. And like what's been discussed and mentioned already, you know, it's a small group of individuals who are normally on the defense. The numbers are so small for a reason, but also too, that's also the direct result of why they're so violent. Most of the time, you know, when you have marginalized groups, they try to defend themselves to whatever degree is necessary. And when you talk about refugees and individuals who come to a new place and a new environment where they don't know the language, the culture, or the system, that is a direct result of that. And unfortunately, for humans, we just know that survival is within our instincts, and most of the times that leads to people doing have to go to drastic measures. So that's just my comment about the gang.
Leo, I appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much for calling in. Jose Miguel, what's your reaction?
Well, a reaction to both interventions. I think it's important to say that not all Central American communities, not all communities by Central Americas are controlled by gangs or they have a problem with gangs. To put an example, for instance, Miami. Miami has a large Central American community, but you don't see problems of gangs or MS-13 in Miami. Indeed, there might be some expressions here and there, but you don't see the level of gang formation and violence that you see in other communities. So first, I think it's important to consider that not all Central American communities are ravaged by gangs in the United States. And second, certainly, I agree with what the latest caller said that, I mean, this is a small group. Even by gang standards in the United States, it's just a fraction. There are many other gangs in the United States that are very large.
Mm-hmm.
So MS-13 is just, you know, a small group. And basically, they certainly perform very brutal and horrible acts in some communities. But this is basically concentrated in some of these communities, especially in the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is important to develop policies very much centered on what is happening at the local level in order to fight this gang.
Right. Jose Miguel and Hannah, both stand by. I want to dig a little bit deeper into the politics surrounding this. And for that, Sean Sullivan joins us from Washington. He covers national politics for The Washington Post. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Hi, John.
I want to start by playing a piece of sound that was recorded after President Trump called MS-13 gang members animals last month. The House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called his comments a new low and criticized him for branding migrants as murderers. Take a listen.
When the President of the United States says about undocumented immigrants, these aren't people, these are animals, you have to wonder, does he not believe in the spark of divinity, the dignity and worth of every person?
Now, Sean Sullivan, in response to that statement, we've had everyone from the chairwoman of the National Republican Party to the former governor of Arkansas, who happens to be the father of the White House press secretary, associate Nancy Pelosi with MS-13 and say, you know, this is her campaign committee. She's defending MS-13. Why are they doing that?
Well, this is part of a longer-term concerted effort that we've seen from Trump and from the Republican Party really since the beginning of the president's campaign. What they're doing is they are portraying a real threat from undocumented immigrants. Recall when President Trump launched his campaign the very first day that he declared his candidacy for president and gave a speech. He said, you know, when Mexico is sending its people, they're not sending their best. He said they're sending rapists, they're bringing drugs. So from the very outset of Trump's candidacy for president, we've seen him try to frame the immigration debate as one in which he positions himself as a protector of American citizens against very violent, bloodthirsty, undocumented immigrants. That's the picture he wants to portray. You fast forward 2 years later, we're in the middle of a midterm campaign right now, and Republicans are trying to villainize Nancy Pelosi at the same time as they make this argument about immigration. Pelosi is somebody who's been in the public limelight for more than a decade. She's somebody who is very, very disliked by Republican voters. So you're seeing a sort of two-prong effort here by Trump and the Republicans. They know that immigration is an issue that really resonates with Trump's base and will excite them to come out and vote in November. And they know that Nancy Pelosi and the dislike for Pelosi is very strong in the Republican base. And so they're essentially combining those two issues in an effort to get Trump's voters to come out in the fall, even though Trump himself is not on the ballot.
Sean Sullivan, Jose Miguel, Hannah Dreyer, hold right there. We're talking criminal cartels, youth gangs, and the politics around our broken immigration system. You can join the conversation. Is MS-13 going to be a voting issue in this fall's midterm election campaign? Should it be? And also, the Supreme Court has just come down with a decision on President Trump's travel ban. We'll talk about that decision shortly. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking about MS-13 and the role it's playing in the controversy over the White House's zero-tolerance policy on our southern border. You can join the conversation. Are Democrats really defending this violent gang, as the president and fellow Republicans claim? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Sean Sullivan, who covers national politics for The Washington Post, Hannah Dreyer, who's been covering MS-13 for ProPublica for the last year, and Jose Miguel Cruz, who's director of research at Florida International University's Latin American and Caribbean Center, an expert on Central American gangs, and himself a Salvadoran. I want to start by playing a piece of sound from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. In February, Sessions warned the National Sheriff's Association that MS-13 in El Salvador members are capitalizing on flaws in U.S. immigration policies and sending fresh recruits over the border into this country.
MS-13 gang members back in El Salvador have taken notice of what's happening. They know that hundreds of their members are now behind bars, so now they're trying to send younger, more violent gang members to the United States to replenish their ranks.
Hannah Dreyer, does your reporting suggest to you that what the Attorney General said is true?
What I'm seeing is that people are being recruited into this gang once they get here. And people who live in Central America and study the gang say the same thing, that the gang isn't sending people across the border. They're just not organized to that degree. They're not this global cartel. It's a disorganized gang, and what they're doing in the U.S., from what I've seen, is taking advantage of kids who come up here who don't speak the language, who feel isolated and lost, like most teenagers in any community do. And they're recruiting those kids into the gang. And I think that's why the conversation that we're having really matters, because this gang is a threat to some people. And to fight the threat, you have to understand what you're dealing with. And this idea that people are being purposefully sent up here doesn't make sense to me. And it's not needed, because the gang is so successful recruiting teenagers who are already here.
Jose Miguel Cruz, do you agree with Hannah that it is unlikely that there is a purposeful decision to send new members into the United States?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I haven't, in my research, I haven't had any evidence. I haven't found any evidence of the gang basically purposefully sending gang members to the United States, right? And what Hannah says is true. Basically, most of the gang members join the gang, most of the kids who join the gang, they join in the place where they start having some contacts with other gang members. Sometimes that process starts just, you know, by playing and just making some signs and using the letters. And if the kid of the children of these teenagers don't have any support from the family or the community, and they spend most of the time alone without any supervision, well, usually they will end up in the arms of the gang. But that's a very, very localized process. It's not that the gang is sending, you know, their people across borders and to basically invade the U.S. and other countries in Europe.
Sean Sullivan, is it your impression that as a matter of politics, that the focus of the administration on MS-13 is working?
Well, it depends on which voters you are talking to. When you talk to voters who are strong supporters of Trump, who supported his hardline immigration message from the very beginning, and you know, for the voters who were drawn to Trump for that very reason, this resonates with them. They like what they see. They see a president who is taking control of a volatile situation and trying to assert himself and trying to protect American citizens. But there are a lot of voters who are very, very turned off by this, and particularly in urban, suburban areas, exurban areas around the country where there are a lot of House seats, House districts that are up for grabs this fall. We're seeing a lot of moderate voters, Democratic voters, even some Republicans turned off by the rhetoric that we hear from Trump, by hearing him try to dehumanize undocumented immigrants and gang members using words like animals. And so the effect is that an already polarized electorate becomes even more polarized by this issue. You have Trump's base very, very revved up by this, and you have voters who were already inclined not to support Trump with an even greater incentive to vote for a candidate who is not supported by the president, to vote for a candidate who's running against Republicans. So, you know, there's a really, really sharp divide in terms of how voters tend to see and perceive what Trump is saying about MS-13 and more broadly about undocumented immigrants.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Mary, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, John. I just wanted to I'm an attorney here in Charlotte, and I am currently working on two MS-13 cases. One is a RICO case, and one is a capital case. And I think that MS-13, based on what I've learned working on these cases, is a convenient boogeyman for the president and his administration.
Clarifying, you're a defense attorney, Mary?
No, not a defense attorney. I work for the judge.
Okay.
On the case.
Okay.
So I'm a law clerk. But the testimony that I've heard reinforces what your guests have said, is that they recruit in their neighborhoods. They're very click oriented. They're known by, like, Nova. They're known by their cliques. And they offer these kids, a lot of whom have parents who work all the time, you know, they're immigrant parents, work hard jobs, and they're left alone. And the gang offers them excitement. It offers them a sense of belonging and family. And the notion that this is like the mafia or the Mexican mafia or an international drug cartel just is false. It's not that they are not a very violent gang. As I said, you've got RICO conspiracy and you've got capital murder. But you ask any local law enforcement group, and they're very familiar with this group. They work with the FBI. They work with the local PD. They work with the DEA. They work with Homeland Security. And they're very active in deporting a lot of these guys when they find them. But they are a local, they're a transnational, thanks to us. But they are more community-oriented, clique-oriented, and there's no central organization. Anyway, I just think it's convenient. Convenient for the president to be able to wrap it up in a nice, simple to understand for his base by lumping everybody into an MS-13 group.
Mary, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate that perspective. Hannah, does Mary's description from Charlotte, North Carolina, track what you have seen and reported on in Long Island?
Totally. I mean, I've looked through these gang members' text messages, and what I see them saying over and over again is, you guys are my family.
Jose Miguel, quick thought in the few seconds we have left?
Yeah, I mean, these are kids. These are teenagers trying to belong to something. And unfortunately, the MS-13 is the only thing that they find in their neighborhoods sometimes.
Well, this is obviously a crime story and a social story that we're going to be following for quite a long time. Hannah Dreyer is a reporter for ProPublica. Hannah, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, John.
Sean Sullivan, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you, too.
Thanks, Sean.
And Jose Miguel Cruz, Director of Research at Florida International University's Latin American and Caribbean Center, my thanks to you as well.
Thank you, John.
In a moment, a blockbuster Supreme Court ruling. This is On Point. The Supreme Court ruled today in one of the earliest and most contentious policies of the Trump administration, and it was a big decision. The court upheld the revised travel ban that has kept most people from five Muslim-majority countries out of the United States. It was a 5-4 vote along party lines, which is to say the justices aligned with the conservative bloc appointed by Republican presidents and the more liberal justices appointed by Democratic presidents. Joining me now from Washington is Ghadir Abbas. He's a senior litigation attorney for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, often referred to as CAIR, C-A-I-R. Ghadir, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
What's your interpretation of this decision and the significance of it?
Well, it's a really disappointing decision, and it's no doubt a setback to the Muslim community and its allies who have pushed for, since the very beginning of the Trump administration, for an end to the Muslim ban. And the Supreme Court's decision ultimately is an invitation to the Trump administration to re-inject discrimination back into our immigration system. More than half a century ago, Congress abandoned what was a overtly racist immigration system that preferred whites over others. And this decision, unfortunately, I think is a milestone, is an indication that there's an abandonment of that commitment. And additionally, you know, it really should have been as obvious to the Supreme Court as it is to the Muslims that are demonized by the Muslim ban that ultimately, in the final analysis, the Muslim ban is an expression of animosity towards Islam and an attempt to demonize Muslims. That's what it is. That's what it feels like. And this is a setback, but it's not the end of the road.
Now, given the makeup of the court ideologically, and the attempts by the administration to cure the constitutional defects of the previous iterations of the travel ban, was this surprising?
Yes, it was surprising. You know, it was when the first Muslim ban came out, remember, it was not only applied to foreign nationals, it was applied to green card holders. So it wasn't only an attempt to stop Muslim immigration, it was an attempt to expel Muslims that were lawfully present inside the United States. And through activism and legal challenges, the Trump administration narrowed the Muslim ban, but it still applied to more than 100 million people across the world. It still separated Muslim citizens from their wives, from their husbands, from their children, from their sisters and brothers. And so we were hopeful that a fair-minded review of the facts, which include statements that the president makes over and over again on Twitter and elsewhere, that the Muslim ban is what it is, an expression of animosity that reflects ultimately the president understands that the details and minutiae of the Muslim ban will be forgotten. But what will be remembered is the fact that we banned Muslims from immigrating to the United States in large part. And that's something that the Muslim community is going to remember forever and will continue to remain committed along with its allies to fighting against.
Was there a particular justice who ended up joining the majority who you had hoped would side with the four dissenters?
Yeah. So there was, I think, most folks against the Muslim ban were hopeful that either Justice Roberts or Justice Kennedy would join the liberal justices in rejecting the Muslim ban. And, you know, there was the Masterpiece Cake Shop case earlier this term, just a few weeks ago, that Kennedy wrote, where he gave a really detailed assessment of the context and history of, you know, a state agency making a decision and that was grounded, in his view, in religious animosity. And that decision thought would bode somewhat favorably for the outcome of the Muslim ban. But here, both Kennedy and Roberts sided with the conservative bloc and ruled pretty comprehensively against the state of Hawaii and made it very difficult for lawsuits to continue. But at the end of the day, the Supreme Court only said that the litigants were unlikely to succeed, not that they did not succeed. And so while it was reversed, which is bad, it was also remanded. These lawsuits will continue to course their way through courts.
That's a big thing. Let's stop on that for a second. This does not erase legal challenges to the travel ban. It simply, as I understand it, reverses a previous ruling that stayed the travel ban, and these cases will then proceed and go to trial?
Yeah, that's the hope. So the order of the Supreme Court was to remand the cases, and so that what that means is because all of the cases are at a very preliminary stage, right? The tactics of litigants was to immediately seek relief from the court on an emergency basis because it affected so many people right away. What the Supreme Court did today was to essentially say narrowly that the preliminary relief, the staying of the injunction while the case is pending, is not appropriate because, in the Supreme Court's view, we're unlikely to succeed. But there's still pathways forward.
Your expectation for what's the right way to think about the timeline for when these cases will actually be litigated and decided on the merits?
It could be years. It could be many, many years. When these cases get remanded, and there's a lot of them, everybody is going to have to, every federal judge is going to have to make their own decision about whether to send these cases into discovery, where we could look for documents, smoking gun documents, that indicate that they're clearly expressions of animosity. And we're hopeful that in this administration we'll find those documents.
So the reality is that the Supreme Court said you can put the ban into effect, but then we're going to have the legal arguments.
There's going to be more arguments, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ghadir Abbas, senior litigation attorney for the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point's produced by a team of outstanding young producers. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.